Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Ray Boland, your host today. We'll be talking again with Dr. Howard Glitzman, the physician who wrote the excellent 81-part series for the Discovery Institute's Evolution News blog. The name of the series is The Designed Body and was posted on the Evolution News blog from about February 2015 to September 2016. So welcome again, Doc.
Great to be here again, Ray.
Now, the last time we spoke, you told us that when it comes to being able to explain the development of life over time, you notice that Darwinists tend to either focus only on what's going on at the cellular and molecular level without really mentioning the various controls that are needed at the multicellular level. So even though our cells are regulating internally, when you have a multicellular organism like ourselves, there has to be a greater control involved. And if they actually do try to explain how the different body systems develop and the ability to control something, for example, like calcium, like we discussed in another episode, they only tend to focus on one part of the system at a time without acknowledging that all of the parts have to be present for the system to work properly. Never mind that the body must somehow figure out or understand or know how much calcium is actually needed in order to survive. Sound right?
Yeah, that's right, Ray. And, you know, when it comes to explaining the development of life, you know, you really have to look at it from not only the cellular and molecular level, but also the multicellular or total body level. And this is because, unlike one-celled organisms that can get what they need from their watery surroundings, all of our cells need help from each other to get what they need to live and work properly. So that's why we have, for example, a respiratory system to bring in oxygen and get rid of carbon dioxide, you know, a gastrointestinal system to bring in water, sugar, and protein, and everything else our cells need to function, and a cardiovascular system that transports all of these chemicals to the cells by way of the blood.
Well, the thing that I remember about the last discussion, which came up several times, you kept bringing up the word death when these things just don't work right.
Yeah, sorry about that, Ray, but that's what I'd like to focus on today. I'd like to look at something that Darwinists never talk about. What clinical experience tells us is the commonest cause of death, looking at it from the cellular and the multicellular or total body level. Because if you really think about it, death is the ultimate factor that affects the origin of life, as explained by Darwinism. You know, after all, Darwinism says that life came about by random chance and the laws of nature alone, without an intelligence to guide it. So for Darwinism, death is the final and only arbiter of life. So it would seem to make sense that before you can understand how life came into existence, you must first understand how easily it can die and become non-existent.
Sounds like our life hangs on a very precarious thread from moment to moment.
Yeah, well, you know, we know that even in today's world of modern medical technology, you know, whether someone has a heart attack or a stroke or pneumonia or cancer, you know, that the usual final common pathway for death, which of course would have been the same for our earliest ancestors, is cardiopulmonary arrest. You know, this is when the heart stops or the breathing stops or they both stop at the same time.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, but I guess we need to know how this cardiopulmonary arrest ultimately causes death, though, right?
Exactly, Ray. You know, and to understand this, we need to first look at how it would cause cell death and then total body death. See, the cell is the basic building block of life, and what most people don't know is that the cell dies if it can't control its volume and chemical content. The concentration of chemicals within the water inside the cell is exactly the opposite of what's in the water outside the cell. See, the water inside the cell has a high concentration of potassium and a low concentration of sodium. And the water outside the cell has a high concentration of sodium and a low concentration of potassium. And scientists know that if this difference is not maintained, that cell death takes place. Of course, the dilemma is that due to the laws of nature, potassium naturally tends to leak out of the cell, while sodium, and with it water, naturally tends to leak into it. So if nature was to run its course, the cell would lose control of its volume and chemical content and would die. So to take care of this problem, each cell has about a million sodium-potassium pumps in its cell membrane that use energy to constantly pump sodium and with it water out of the cell and bring potassium back in to maintain its volume and chemical content. In fact, it's estimated that at complete rest, one quarter to one half of the body's energy needs are taken up by these millions of sodium-potassium pumps doing what they need to do in each of our trillions of cells.
Well, that's kind of hard to imagine. A million of these pumps per cell and then multiply that by another trillion cells, that's an awful lot of energy just for that sodium-potassium balance. Now, I know that the cells that get the energy they need from the nutrients in the blood by using a very specific set of proteins to release it from the glucose molecule, but primarily in the presence of oxygen, a process that's called cellular respiration.
Yes, Ray, and so with cardiopulmonary arrest, the blood flow throughout the body becomes compromised, and with it, the ability to provide the cells with enough oxygen.
And without enough oxygen, there's not enough energy in the cells to power those millions of sodium-potassium pumps, which makes them fail. When the sodium-potassium pumps fail, then, as you said earlier, the cells lose control of their volume and chemical content, and they die.
Yes, that's right. But, you know, that only explains the death of a given cell in the body, but not total body death. You know, it turns out that when it comes to life and death, not all of the cells in the body have equal importance. You know, after all, you can live without an arm or a leg, and it takes a lot of damage to the cells of organs like the liver and the kidneys and the lungs before it will affect your survival. But there are certain groups of cells in the brain and the heart that must always remain functional or else death takes place immediately. Now, these include the pacemaker and other cells in your heart that generate the electrical messages for it to pump, and the cells in the respiratory center of the brainstem that tell you to breathe in air, and with it, oxygen. So one can see that if the body is to stay alive, it has to make sure that these cells always have what they need to function properly. Otherwise, death will take place very quickly. And as you just noted, the most important thing needed is oxygen.
Well, but then you'd also indicated that glucose, the source of the energy, is also extremely important since the energy comes from the glucose molecule. But what about even having enough water for the cells, too? So you've got water, glucose, and oxygen.
Well, those are good points, Ray. But turns out that the body can store water and sugar. So although not having enough of them can cause death, it usually takes time for this to happen. But the body has no way to store oxygen, and its need for it is so acute, just as it is for an appliance to have an electrical energy, that by pulling the plug, cardiopulmonary arrest quickly results in the death of these vital cells and consequently total body death as well.
Well, I know from my own personal experience, even my own research, that cellular respiration, the use of oxygen and the enzymes to release and store energy from glucose is an extremely complex process. But before we step further into this now, I just want to highlight for our listeners that a couple of things which we've already covered. First of all, that the sodium potassium have to be kept in balance in the cell. The cell needs energy with using oxygen, which cannot be stored in the body in order to maintain that balance. And if the oxygen, however, is shut off by cardiopulmonary arrest, the sodium potassium then leaks out of the cell or into the cell, depending upon the ion, and the O2 needed is basically needed every second that we're alive, and we can't get along without it. So how does the body ensure that it's all getting enough oxygen?
That's exactly what we're going to look at, Ray, and I want you and your audience to notice the different parts needed to get the job done and wonder where they all came from, how the system could have worked without each part being present, and finally, where the information came from for the body to know how much oxygen it actually needs. But before I begin, I have to add something to what you said about cellular respiration. Not only is oxygen used to release the energy from the glucose molecule, but the chemical byproducts of this reaction are water and carbon dioxide. Now, the body can handle the water, but it can't handle having too much carbon dioxide. So when you hold your breath, within a few seconds, the oxygen level in your blood begins to drop, and the carbon dioxide level begins to rise. Now, this takes place, of course, because your cells are constantly using up oxygen and producing carbon dioxide through cellular respiration to get the energy they need to work properly. So everyone knows that without enough oxygen, we can't live very long, you know, only a few minutes. But what most people don't know is that, just as I commented before, having too much carbon dioxide in your blood is toxic to your cells, particularly your brain cells, and causes death as well. So your body has to be able to control not only the amount of oxygen in the blood, but also its level of carbon dioxide.
Now, if I remember the lesson from a previous episode about the control system, first, you need some sort of sensor, as you indicated, like a thermometer that senses temperature, to detect what needs to be controlled. Then there also needs to be an integrator, what I refer to as an interpreter, to take that information from the sensor, compare it somehow with some standard, and decide if something needs to be done, and then send out orders. And then there has to be an effector or effectors that receive those orders and simply do then what needs to be done.
Yes, Ray. You know, just like the sensor in the fuel tank connected to the correct gauge on the dashboard tells you how much fuel your car has, so too sensors in the main arteries leading to and within your brain detect the changes in the blood levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide, and this information is sent to the respiratory center in your brain. Now, the cells of the respiratory center, acting as the integrator, seem to inherently know what the normal levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide should be in your blood. So when you hold your breath for a few seconds and your blood level of oxygen drops and carbon dioxide level rises, the respiratory center sends out messages telling you to breathe in an attempt to bring these levels back to normal. So experience tells us that the longer we ignore this urge to breathe, the more intense it becomes as the blood level of oxygen drops and carbon dioxide rises further. Now, the respiratory center, having already given us fair warning, now becomes ever more demanding by sending out stronger messages to try to prevent our death from not having enough oxygen and having too much carbon dioxide. And when we finally do take a breath, this is done by messages from the respiratory center traveling down the spinal cord into the motor nerves, which release a neurotransmitter that tells the muscles of respiration to contract. Now, the main muscle of respiration is the diaphragm, and when it contracts, this increases the volume of your chest cavity, and air, just like a vacuum, is sucked into your lungs, where it travels along the airways to the alveoli. The alveoli are grape-like sacs located deep inside your lungs that are surrounded by hundreds of capillaries, and it's here where the exchange of gases takes place. Oxygen enters the blood from the inhaled air, and carbon dioxide leaves the blood and goes into the air to be exhaled. This all causes the oxygen and carbon dioxide levels in your blood to return to normal. Now, once again, the sensors in the main arteries leading to and within your brain detect and relay this new information to the respiratory center, and in response, it turns off the urge for you to breathe, at least for the next few seconds.
That's really an awful lot of information, an incredibly complex system, and there are so many necessary parts. And I know that for some people who like to test themselves holding their breath, if you actually do hold it too long, the brain takes over and causes you to pass out, which allows all that breathing to finally happen again. So there is a very real process happening here and a real complex system. So how did Darwinists even try to explain how this system came into existence?
Well, from my experience, when you read what they write about the evolution of respiratory function, they just gloss over the details. In essence, they simply comment on the parts needed, compare them with the ones in different types of organisms, and then state that all of this came about by evolution. Evolution, of course, understood as Darwinism. And they do this without explaining how the system could have functioned without a given part each step along the way, never mind how the respiratory center happens to know what the levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide should be for total body survival.
That's really pretty amazing. Sort of makes you see how Darwin's idea of the gradual step-by-step development of life, which is the whole basis of the theory, you can't get to this system by a simple step-by-step process. You're dead on arrival.
Yes, Ray, but, you know, you really can't fault Darwin and his compatriots because, you know, back then they didn't know how life actually works. And more importantly, what was needed to prevent death. But the same cannot be said about modern Darwinists.
You know, I even said myself that in considering the incredible complexity of the cell, that if that was known in Darwin's time, he probably wouldn't have even bothered with his theory. But it's been around long enough that they just keep adapting it to new information. So this is all just incredibly fascinating, learning how life actually works.
Yeah, right. And speaking of that, when it comes to getting enough oxygen to the cells and the tissues, we've only come part of the way so far. You know, we know that the laws of nature state that for work to be done, energy is needed. And that's why our cells die, and so do we, when we don't have enough oxygen. But there are more laws of nature to think about.
All right. Well, that sounds like something for another episode. And again, my guest has been Dr. Howard Glicksman. And I'm your host, Ray Bolin. And thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.